So I've got a message today that is about you and about me personally, and it's also about our community faith corporately, but in order to get there, we have to go back 2,000 years, and we're going to read some interesting historical stuff about a situation that happened a couple thousand years ago. We're going to read some words that were written 2,000 years ago, and for me, it's really interesting and fun and exciting stuff, but it might feel a little boring to you, but if it does, hang in there, because the ending of today's sermon is going to be awesome. So there will be a reward for perseverance, so hang in there, all right? Now, we're reading this book, it's called Galatians, and we started a series a couple weeks ago, and it's not actually a book, you have to remember it was a letter. It was originally a letter written by a guy named Paul, the Apostle Paul, to a group of people who lived in Galatia, which was a Roman province in what's called Asia Minor, we call it Turkey today. And the reason he wrote them a letter is because he had traveled there a year before this. And he had traveled there and he had told some Gentiles, these Greek-speaking people, Gentile means they were not Jewish, these Greek-speaking people about Jesus. And he said, you can believe in him and you can follow him and you can become a follower of Jesus. And they said, yes, we want to be followers of Jesus. Not many, but a few people in this area of Galatia did that. And so Paul helped them set up little communities of faith. And he said, here's even better news. You don't have to become Jewish to become a follower of Jesus. And they said, that's awesome, because we weren't interested in becoming Jewish. Like, we just wanted to be followers of Jesus. And so Paul helped them set up these communities of faith. And then he left. And then about a year later, he got some bad news. He heard that things had fallen apart in Galatia, because apparently some people had come after him and had told these new Greek believers and followers of Jesus, there's a whole bunch of stuff they actually had to do first to be worthy, for God to consider them worthy to be followers of Jesus. And it made Paul really upset. And so that's what we're going to look at today, why Paul is upset and what's going on. And there's a whole bunch of stuff happening here about Jews and Gentiles, and I'm going to try to explain some of that. But here's what you need to know. It's really about the issue of worth. It's about worth. How do we find worth as human beings? And that's really important for us to ask and to explore. So here's where we're going to pick up. We're going to pick up in chapter 2, starting in verse 1. Paul's actually in the middle of telling this long story. We stopped in the middle last week. And so we'll just jump right into it, and I'll explain it as we go. Here's what he says. He says, then, after 14 years, I went up again to Jerusalem, this time with Barnabas, and I took Titus along also. So Paul had been telling this story about how he himself had become a Christian. And so about 14 years after he became a Christian, he says up to Jerusalem. He was living in Antioch at the time, which is north, but it was up in elevation to go to Jerusalem. So that's how they spoke about it at that time. And he had already gone to Jerusalem once, right after he became a Christian. We read about that last week. But now he's saying, I went back to Jerusalem another time. And I went with my friend Barnabas, and we took our friend Titus with us. And then he tells us why he went. He goes on. He says, I went in response to a revelation. And meeting privately with those esteemed as leaders, I presented to them the gospel that I preach among the Gentiles. I wanted to be sure I was not running and had not been running my race in vain. So Paul says, first, I went to Jerusalem down there first because of a revelation, which just means God told me to go, right? And maybe God didn't say it audibly, but I felt like God was telling me I needed to go down there. Now, we also know that at this time, there was a great famine happening in the Jerusalem or the Judea area, and news had reached Antioch, and so the church in Antioch had gathered a collection. They had raised money and put together this donation, and they were going to send it down to Jerusalem, and so Paul and Barnabas said, hey, we'll be the ones. This is a great opportunity. We'll take the donation down to Jerusalem because we would like to go down there anyways. And so Paul heads down there to meet with the leaders. That's who he talks about, those esteemed in Jerusalem. And one of the reasons he wants to go down there, this is probably before his trip to Galatia, probably right before his trip to Galatia, is that he had this conviction to go tell people who were not Jews, those are Gentiles, about Jesus. He had seen some people in Antioch that were Gentiles become Christians. And remember, that's new, because all the followers of Jesus up until this point were Jews. Jesus was Jewish. The original 12 disciples were Jewish. All the people that were early followers of Jesus believed that Jesus was the Messiah for the Jewish people. So all the followers of Jesus were Jews. But in Antioch, we first see some people who are Gentiles start becoming Christians. In fact, Antioch is the first place where they use the word Christian, and they're called Christian. And so Paul sees these groups, and he believes his message or his goal is to go tell people, especially Gentiles, about Jesus. But he knows there's maybe the potential for division. Like, as these Gentiles become followers of Jesus, but most people who are followers of Jesus lose Jews, there might be a potential for division. So he wants to head down to Jerusalem to make sure that everything's okay with the leaders down there, to make sure that he's not going to be working against them or they're not going to be working against him, and they're all sort of on the same page. And yet, then look at what Paul says next, because here's the problem he maybe foresees. He says this next. He says, yet not even Titus, who was with me, was compelled to be circumcised. What? What are you talking about? Even though he was a Greek. This matter arose because some false believers had infiltrated our ranks to spy on the freedom that we have in Christ Jesus and to make us slaves. And we did not give in to them for a moment so that the truth of the gospel might be preserved for you. Now, this feels like a hard right turn. Like, what in the world is Paul talking about? But it's really, really important. Because apparently some people had come into the church, and Paul calls them false believers here. Some people had come into this church in Antioch, and they were probably the same people who had gone to the church in Galatia. And they had said to these new Greek followers of Jesus, actually, there's a whole bunch of stuff that you need to do first. There's a whole list of things that you've got to start doing for God to consider you worthy to even be a follower of Jesus. And as odd as that sounds to us, there's a list of things that, like, you have to do first. That would have been really common and normal back then. In fact, let me unpack this a little bit. Let's go back to the Old Testament. You remember in the book of Exodus, God rescues the people of Israel from Egypt, and then he gives them the Ten Commandments. He says, you shall have no other gods before me. And that's going to be different than all the other people in the Promised Land because they worship all kinds of different gods. And so he says, I want you to be different than everybody else. I want you to look different. I want you to dress different. I want you to eat different foods. I want you to worship different. I just want everything about you to be totally different from all the other people that live around you. You're going to be countercultural in that sort of way. And so if you were from another people group, another nationality, if you were an Amalekite or a Hittite or a Jebusite or a Persian or an Assyrian or a Babylonian, and you wanted to start following the Hebrew people's God, if you came to believe, you know, the gods that we've been worshiping aren't true gods. The God that the Jews worship is the one true God, and I want to start following that one. Well, then you had to change all that other stuff about you too. You had to start wearing all the same clothes that they started wearing. You had to eat the same kind of foods they ate. You had to do all the same things. You had to keep their laws because their laws were different than yours. You basically had to become an Israelite. It wasn't just a matter of believing in your heart. You didn't just say, well, I'm going to stop believing in my God and start believing. That's a very modern notion of faith. At that time, it wasn't enough to do that. At that time, you had to adopt all of their cultural practices and all of their cultural ways if you wanted to become an Israelite. And really, throughout the entire Old Testament, nothing changes. And all the way up to the time of Paul, if you were a Gentile and you wanted to believe in the Jewish God, then you had to adopt all of the things that made Jews, Jews. All of their sort of badges of identity and honor, all of the things that they believed were the most important. And there were three things by the time of Paul that the Jewish people sort of thought were the most important things about their identity. And three things that if you were a Gentile and you wanted to convert, you had to adopt these three things as well. And I just want to explain them to you real quickly. The first was holidays. Holidays. You had to embrace the Jewish holidays. You had to start doing Passover and Yom Kippur and the Feast of Tabernacles and Sabbath. You had to keep Sabbath. Nobody kept Sabbath back then. That was a Jewish thing. Nobody else did that. There weren't weekends back then. People just worked all the time. This was a totally different kind of thing. And you had to start doing that if you wanted to become Jewish. And here's the second one. The second thing was food. Jews had all kinds of laws about which foods were clean and which foods were unclean, which meats you could eat and what meats you couldn't eat, how you were supposed to prepare certain food and how you weren't supposed to prepare it. And we call it now keeping kosher. And keeping kosher for them was extremely important because their kosher practices were different than everyone else. Their food was different, the way they prepared their food. And so they didn't even share their table with Gentiles because they just knew if they went over to somebody's house that was a Gentile, they'd be eating Gentile meat and they'd be eating Gentile food and would be prepared their way. And that was wrong and that was unclean. And so they just separated themselves. When it came to food and the table, they totally separated themselves from all non-Jews. In fact, Jews during this time were like the original gluten-free people, right? They had this dietary practice, but it was almost on steroids. Like for them, they had this dietary restriction, right? And yet they kept it so seriously. And so some of you are gluten-free, and yet for you, it's a health thing. And it's a health thing. And 90% of you that are gluten-free are really gracious about it. And it's a pain. And you wish you didn't have to do it. And when you go over to someone else's house, you know that they're probably not going to be gluten-free. And you're going to have to explain to them. And so you're just going to have to bring your own food with you. And you're really gracious because you have to fit into everyone else's. When the whole culture is eating differently than you, you have to fit into that, right? But every now and then, you meet someone who's gluten-free, or they're a vegan, or they have one of those things, and they're kind of obnoxious about it, right? They kind of look down on everyone else, and you get the sense that they just kind of look at you, and they think they're better than you because you eat this horrible food, and they eat really. And if they came in and saw a table with donuts on it, that would just represent the epitome of unhealth and sickness and disease, and they wouldn't even go close to it, right? Because it's just nothing but gluten, right? Take that mentality, multiply it by 10, and now you understand Jews during Paul's day when it came to their food practices. They just separated from everything because that's what the rotten, pagan, wicked Gentiles eat. So holidays, food practices, and then the third thing was circumcision. Circumcision. And let me explain this for a second. Physically, circumcision was something that only males did. And yet, remember, it was a patriarchal society. And so in that day, the male or the man often represented the whole family. So it wasn't just something that applied to half of the Jewish population. That men were, in that sense, representing everyone. Now, circumcision, I didn't really understand what it was growing up. Circumcision, just to put it bluntly, is they would take a baby, usually at 8 days old, and it was a surgical procedure where the tip, it's called the foreskin, of their private part is cut off. And it was a very religious thing for them. It was very sacred because it represented, for males at least, the most intimate part of you being cut off and offered to God. It was like a sacrifice. But it also represented a mark, a permanent mark, like a tattoo, right? Or even more permanent than that, a scar, something that showed you were a part of God's chosen family. You're a part of his favored community. You are one of his own, unlike all the other people who are uncircumcised. And so, if you were a Gentile and you wanted to become a Jew during this time, you had to embrace the holidays, you had to embrace the food laws, and you had to be circumcised. And if you were a grown man during a time when there was no anesthesia, that was a big deal. Now, for early followers of Jesus, nothing was different. They were all Jews. They didn't stop celebrating the holidays. They didn't stop keeping kosher and adhering to all of their food practices, and they didn't stop circumcising their children. They kept doing all of those things. And so if you were a Gentile, if you were a Greek, if you were someone who wasn't a follower of Jesus and you wanted to become a follower of Jesus, don't you still have to do all of those things? You know what Paul said? He said, no, you don't have to do any of those things. You don't have to be circumcised. You don't have to keep the food laws. You don't have to do any of those things. And think about the good news of that. I mean, think about how Paul would have talked to his buddy Titus. Titus, I want to share the gospel with you. Remember, gospel just means good news. I want to share the gospel with you. Here's the good news. Jesus died for your sins. Wow, that's good news. And you can follow him. Wow, that's good news. And you don't have to be circumcised. Wow, that is good news, right? And yet, Paul says some people came along and they disagreed with him. And he calls them false believers, and later he'll call them the circumcision group, because they basically came along and said, no, that's not how the way it works. I mean, we had to do all those things, and those are the things that made us worthy before God. Those are the things that made us part of his favored and chosen and blessed people. And if you want to be a part of that, you got to be circumcised, and you have to do all of those things as well. And so Paul realizes that this could be a problem, and he goes down to Jerusalem to talk to the leaders of the church about how to deal with this potential problem as it arises. And this is what happens. He takes Titus with him as well. This is what happens. In verse 6, he goes on. He says, as for those who are held in high esteem, those are the leaders of the church now. He's talking about Peter and James. Whatever they were makes no difference to me. God does not show favoritism, and they added nothing to my message. On the contrary, they recognized that I had been entrusted with the task of preaching the gospel to the uncircumcised, just as Peter had been to the circumcised. So Paul says a couple of amazing things here. First, he calls his leaders in Jerusalem those held in high esteem. And literally, it's those who seem to be important. Those who appear to be important, those who by all, and that's not a condescending term, he's just saying by all of our standards of how we rank who's important and who's not, these are the people that are most important. He says that three times in the passage, those who are in high esteem, those who seem to be important. But then he says, but it doesn't matter to me. They're not important to me. You know why? Because it doesn't matter to God. God doesn't show favoritism. Literally, God takes no account of human appearance. Or God takes no account of human values. God takes no account of human criteria or standards of worth. God doesn't operate that way. That's not how God sees people. That may be how you see people. When you see people, you might say, well, they're important, they're not. They're in, they're out. They're worthy, they're not. Like you rank people and I rank people. We all rank people that way, but that's not how God ranks people. He doesn't see people that way. Now, the second amazing thing that Paul says right here is he says that even Peter and James and all the leaders realized and recognized that he was right, and that what he was telling Gentiles was right, and that he had a good news to go and tell to Gentiles or non-Jews or the uncircumcised, just like Peter had a good news to go tell to the circumcised. Which, let's just back, I mean, we skip right over that, but just think about that phrase for a second. The good news or the gospel to the uncircumcised. No good Jew would have ever said that in that time. That's an oxymoron to them. That doesn't make sense. The uncircumcised are the filthy, like horrible pagans who can't please God and don't have any of the things or haven't done any of the things that we have done. There is no good news for them except that God is displeased with them until they start doing all those things. And yet, Paul is challenging this one thing, this one such an important symbol of worth to them. They have this symbol of worth, circumcision. That's who's worthy. And he's saying, no, it's not. And for us, it's a little hard to get our minds around, right? It's still hard to understand why circumcision was so important. But don't we still have symbols of worth? I mean, don't we in our culture have status symbols as well? I mean, what do you think those are? A college degree is not a symbol of worth. Maybe a graduate degree, maybe a degree from a certain kind of institution. A spouse and a family, aren't those symbols of worth? I mean, we say, well, no, not really, but you know how it is in our culture. If you're 35 or you're 45 or you're 50 and you're not married, it's like, well, something must be wrong with you. And then we say, well, no, nothing's wrong. They're just focused on their career. She's just really focused on her job, right? We just replace one status symbol of worth with another that they must be pursuing instead. Our careers can be symbols of worth. A white-collar job, right? Don't we subtly all think that a white-collar job is somehow better than a blue-collar job? A good-paying salary, maybe? A single-family home, right? I mean, isn't that the American dream that one day you'll finally reach the point where you can own your own home and spend every Saturday at Home Depot with everyone else, right? Or in Colorado, what's a symbol of worth? A Subaru with a roof rack, right? Maybe a mountain bike or a snowboard on top. I mean, doesn't that represent something for us? Don't we have these tokens or these symbols of worth and identity? And what Paul is saying here is these things don't give us worth. It's not that these things are actually bad. They're not bad a good job, a SUV. I mean, they're not bad in and of themselves, because he doesn't say circumcision is bad. I mean, in this case, he says Titus didn't get circumcised. Titus wasn't a Jew. He didn't need to. But he doesn't then go and say, and all the Jews should stop circumcising their kids. He doesn't say that either. It's just not something that God accounts worth to. It's not something that should give us identity and worth. And the things that we've taken and wrapped our identity and our worth up in, we need to figure out how to unwrap those. That's what Paul is trying to say. And so there's good news to the circumcised. And the good news that Peter can take to the circumcised is this: hey, you've been doing all these things, and guess what? God doesn't give you worth because of that. God doesn't love you because you are keeping all the laws and doing all the right things. That's not why God gave his son Jesus for you. And there's also a good news to the uncircumcised. Hey, guess what? All the people that have told you you have to do all these things to earn God's approval and love and worth, you don't have to do all those things. There's good news for everybody. This is what Paul believes deep in his heart, and that's what the leaders agree to, and here's why they agree to it. Paul goes on, verse 8. He says, "For God, who was at work in Peter as an apostle to the circumcised, was also at work in me as an apostle to the Gentiles. James, Cephas, and John, those esteemed as pillars, gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship when they recognized the charis given to me." That's that word we've been looking at the last couple weeks. Charis just means the gift or the favor that God has been given to me. And they agreed that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. And all they asked was that we should continue to remember the poor, the very thing I had been eager to do all along. So Peter and the leaders realized, look, God is at work in us as we've told Jews about Jesus and that they can put their faith in him. And God has also been at work in Paul and Barnabas as they've told Gentiles that they can believe in Jesus and they don't have to do all that stuff. And if God is at work in both people, then we should pay attention to that. And then they also say, look, God has given a gift, charis, a sense of favor. He's given that to Paul to pass along to Gentiles. The same gift or favor or benefit that he's given to Jews, he's now giving to Gentiles. And if he's giving it to Gentiles who haven't been circumcised, who don't keep the food laws, who don't keep all the holidays, then that means it had nothing to do with those things. Which means God didn't give that to us either. Which means we're all equal. The message can go to anyone that God wants to give his favor to you, and it has nothing to do with all the things that you think have to do with your worth. And so as a result, all the leaders agree, like, all right, they gave the right hand of fellowship. This is this term that basically just means they said to Paul and Barnabas, we're on the same team. We are on the same page, same mission. You guys go to the Gentiles. We'll keep telling Jews about Jesus, and we're all on the same page. Hey, just one thing. Don't forget the poor, because they think, yeah, Paul, you're going to start traveling all around the world. There's going to be all these Gentiles, and you might forget the poor Christians here in Jerusalem. And Paul's like, no, we would never forget the poor. And so as a result, Paul goes on his first journey. He goes up to Asia Minor and Galatia, and he tells Jews, and he also tells a lot of Gentiles about Jesus. And Paul comes back about a year later, and Peter decides to come up to Antioch to visit him, and then look at what happens. Verse 11, after they were on the same team, same page, and everything was going great, when Cephas is Peter, that's his Aramaic name, came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, he used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they arrived, he began to draw back and separate himself from the Gentiles because he was afraid of those who belonged to the circumcision group. So apparently Peter came up to Antioch and he started hanging out with Gentiles and he started sharing meals with Gentiles and he was at the same table with them and he wasn't keeping kosher and he wasn't paying attention to the food laws and he was relaxing and letting go of those things and he wasn't seeing them as filthy or different and he wasn't saying to them, you have to change before I sit at a table with you. He was the one changing, sitting at the table with them. He was letting go of one of the most important things for all of his life that had given him worth and identity. He was letting go of it. And then some men came up and they said they were from James. And we don't know if that's true or not. James had become the leader in the church of Jerusalem. So either James changed his mind and sent them up there, or maybe they just said they were from James and they really weren't. But they came up and they said, Peter, you can't do that. Don't you know we have to keep the food laws? Don't you know we have to keep kosher? Don't you know that's who makes us who we are? And we can't hang out with the Gentiles anymore who aren't keeping our laws and aren't being kosher. We have to separate ourselves from them and their uncleanliness. And Peter slips right back into re-embracing the thing that for most of his life had given him his worth and identity. And in fact, it gets so bad that look at what Paul says next. Next verse, he says, the other Jews joined him in his hypocrisy so that by their hypocrisy, even Barnabas was led astray. So it's not just Peter, but most of the Jews in the church in Antioch start changing their ways and say, no, we can't eat with Gentiles anymore. We have to keep the things that give us worth and identity. We have to do that. And even Barnabas. Right, Barnabas had bought into this. He had traveled with Paul. He had been telling Gentiles everywhere, you don't have to do these things. They're not what gives you worth and identity. And even Barnabas got sucked into right back to the thing that we thought gave us our worth and our identity. And Paul calls it for what it is. He says it's hypocrisy. And then he explains what he means by that. And this is the last thing we're going to read from Paul today. He says this next. He says, when I saw that they were not acting in line with the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas in front of them all, you are a Jew, and yet you live like a Gentile and not like a Jew. How is it then that you force Gentiles to follow Jewish customs? In other words, Peter, you begin to learn that these things are not what gives you identity and worth. And you started to let go of them. You started to live like a Gentile. You joined them at their table. You let go of those things because you learned they're not what gives you identity and worth. And now here you are turning around telling them that they have to do those same things. They have to keep these restrictions that you've learned God doesn't even require of you and you weren't even keeping. What a hypocrite. And Paul is angry. I can't believe this is going on. So he stands up to Peter right then and there. And of course, this brings up all sorts of other questions. Well, what was the purpose of circumcision in the first place, right? And why did they keep all these laws for hundreds of years if they weren't the thing that gave them worth and identity? And what was the purpose of all those things? And how does Jesus just change it all? How does that all work? Well, Paul's going to unpack that in the next few chapters. And we're going to come back and answer some of those questions. But I want to share two takeaways with you today. And the first is personal, and I want to just challenge you with this one, and then we're going to sit with it for a little bit and think about it, and then I'll come back up and share the second one. Here's the first one. When it comes to our worth, actions speak louder than words. When it comes to our worth, actions speak louder than words. You see, Peter could say he was on board with what Paul was saying. Yeah, those things, my circumcision, the food law, that, yeah, I get it. Those things don't give me worth. But then he just slipped right back into living as if they did give him worth. Right there at the table, that's where the rubber met the road. And he decided he just couldn't let go of it anymore. Like it had just been too ingrained. He had been living his whole life that way, and it was too hard. I mean, he could say it, but it was another thing to actually give it up and start living as if his worth and his identity wasn't wrapped up in these things. And I think the same is true for us. We can come to church, and we can say our worth and identity is not wrapped up in all those things. It's wrapped up in Jesus. And then we can live our lives the rest of the week as if it is wrapped up in all of those things. You see, I meet guys all the time who say, well, my work isn't that important to me. And yet, they spend inordinate amounts of time and energy. More than anything else, their focus is on their work and their lives. And it's very clear, no, your worth, your identity is wrapped up in your work. I mean, women who say, well, external, you know, looks or appearance, it doesn't really matter that much to me. And yet they spend inordinate amounts of time and energy and anxiety on how they look to everyone else. And it's clear, no, your worth and your identity is wrapped up in how you look to everyone else. And it's not just that men struggle with their jobs. There's plenty of women who make their careers their identity. And it's not just that women struggle with their looks. There's a lot of men whose identity is wrapped up in how they look to other people. And there's all sorts of other things that we wrap up our identities. And it's not even that these things are bad. Of course we should be good at work. And of course we should look nice. It's just that God doesn't count worth that way. He doesn't look at us and say, that's how I see you. And that's what makes you worth something. And yet for us, when we make those things about our worth and our identity, we turn ourselves into this never-ending saga of always trying to do more, become more, look better, achieve more, gain more worth and identity. And so today, the question I just want to challenge you with is this: is that the way God sees you? Does he see all those things about you? Or does he say something different to you? Would he say something different to you today about your worth and identity? And would he want you to live into that this week? Brian's going to sing a song now, and I want you to just reflect on those questions and think about the words.
That say I'm not enough. Every single lie that tells me I will never measure up. Am I more than just the sum of every high and every again, just who I am, because I need to know. And you say I am loved when I can't feel a thing, and you say I am strong when I think I am weak, and you say I am held when I sure. And when I don't belong, who you say I am yours? And I believe who I believe. What you say to me, who I believe. The only thing that matters now is everything you think of me. In you I find my worth, in you I find my identity. Whoa, 'cause you say I am loved when I can't feel a thing. say I'm strong when I think I'm weak. And you say I'm held when I am falling short. And when I don't belong, well, you say I'm yours. And I believe, ooh, I believe what you say in me. All I have, now I'm laying it at your feet. You have every failure, God, and you'll have every victory. Ooh, 'cause you say I am loved when I can't feel. And you say I'm strong when I think I'm weak. And you say I'm held when I am falling short. And when I don't belong, well, you say I'm yours. And I believe, ooh, I believe what you say.
Something we believe. Is that something this week when you're finding your worth wrapped up in something else, you'll say, no, I'm going to believe something different and live something different. Well, that was the first takeaway. And I said, if you hung in there and persevered, there will be a reward. So let me tell you what the second takeaway is. It's this. At the table, we thank God for his gift. And as a community, we proclaim new criteria of worth. You see, it was at Antioch, it was at a meal table where their criteria of worth was exposed, where Peter said, no, I can't eat with Gentiles anymore. And there was this division. In fact, it happened in another church. Paul went to this place called Corinth, and he found out something was happening there as well, where then when they came together to share meals, there was a division. And it wasn't between Jews and Gentiles there, it was between rich people and poor people. And it's these two examples to help us see that it's at the table. It's at the table when we share a meal together that our criteria of worth are often exposed. And it's at the table that we can come together and say, we don't come to the table because we're worth something. We come to the table because God gives us worth. And I'm using the table very generally because for the early Christians, they didn't celebrate the communion the way we do. They didn't do it once a month. They didn't do it with little pieces of bread and a little thing of juice. They celebrated it at every meal. Every time they broke bread together, every time they had a meal together, it was a way of remembering, we come to a table to feast on the gift that God gives us and to be thankful for that. In fact, have you ever heard this word Eucharist? It's a word that Paul uses, and it's what some Christians call communion. It's a Greek word. Can you tell any word that's a part of the word Eucharist? It's the word charis. Because Eucharist literally means giving thanks for the gift that God has given. And so when we come to the table, we give thanks that God gave his son Jesus to us. We give thanks for that gift, and we give thanks that we don't have to do something to earn our worth before we can come to the table. And yet it also says something about the community when we come to the table. As a community, basically what we're saying is we're going to proclaim a new criteria of worth. Everyone's accepted at the table. Everyone comes to feast. Nobody has to do anything. And that all the old human standards and criteria of worth we had are dissolved away at the table, and we're going to embody a new criteria of worth. And so today, we're going to celebrate communion. And we're going to do it with some really gluten-rich donuts. Seriously, we're going to do it differently today. Because there's, you know, I think there's something about using the bread and the juice and the way we do communion, and we do this as well in our churches. Sometimes it can feel like this really somber, private, reflective thing. And it includes that. That's a part of it. But sometimes we also miss that it's a joyous, thankful thing. It's a table where we come and feast. And we remember God's goodness. And we remember the gift that he's given. And we remember that we're free, that we're not bound by food restrictions anymore. So you can feast on gluten this morning, right? You can enjoy the goodness of the Lord. And if you can't, we have fruit and gluten-free muffins for you as well. But that's how we're going to end our service today. We're going to sing a song, or at least part of a song for a second, and then we're just going to end by saying, come to the table and enjoy some donuts, enjoy some fruit, enjoy some muffins, and we're not going to come back together, and there's not going to be a benediction. We are the benediction to one another. We are the blessing to say, let's just enjoy the gift and linger and hang out and say by our presence together as a community. We don't have old criterias of worth. We find our worth in the gift that God has given to every single one of us. So would you stand now and join me?